Welcome to Diverse Voices Book Review. I'm Hopeton Hay. My guest is Ivy Pakolda. We are talking about her fifth novel, Sing Her Down. Ivy Pakolda is the author of the critically acclaimed novels Wonder Valley, Visitation Street, and most recently, These Women, which was a New York Times best thriller of 2020. For many years, Ivy taught creative writing at Studio 526 in Los Angeles, Skid Row. She is currently a professor of creative writing at the University of California, Riverside, Palm Desert, Low Residency, MFA program, and she lives in Los Angeles. And welcome back to Diverse Voices Book Review.
Thank you so much. I always love coming here.
Well, the first thing I have to let the audience know is you're absolutely one of my favorite writers.
Oh, thank you so much.
And I was not disappointed with Sing Her Down. Matter of fact, what was so cool about it was you took, at least in my estimation, it was a different style to this novel as opposed to the other novels. And it was a style that I, as I was reading through it, I said, interesting. So I have to ask you, and this is a two young women that are in prison in Arizona. One, Dio, seems really obsessed with Florida, whose real name is Florence. One is a former scholarship college student from Queens. The other is a rich girl, but they both ended up in prison at one point, were cellmates.
Right.
And what was the inspiration to bring these characters and to create these characters and to create this narrative around these characters? Because to me, it's like the path is inevitable. Right. So as you're reading a story, you're feeling, you know, and of course you have Case, but you know that there's going to be this inevitable conflict. But what you do so well is, even though you know it's coming, Case is sort of like the Greek chorus. She sort of gives you that big overall view. You know, she talks to ghosts, you know, and you see it coming. You got a little Greek mythology in there. We got some furies in there, deities of vengeance. You know, you're throwing out some classical stuff in there. And so I started trying to figure out, wow, these are all these different sort of interesting things, from ghosts, I think Shakespeare, I think gods and mythology and all these things that you pepper in there, but which really create just this very fascinating whole. So were you inspired by Shakespeare, Greek mythology, or was this something you've been thinking about a long time?
Well, the answer is yes to all of that. I am a classicist by training. I have a degree in classical Greek. So that's where I've studied classics mythology since I was really young. I became obsessed with Greek myths in like sixth grade. I started studying ancient Greek when I was still in middle school and through high school and through college. And then just coincidentally, when I was in college, I kind of got a little tired of studying Greek because we studied the language, not the story, which was irritating to me. So I pivoted and did a dual major in Greek and English and classics. And they told me I had to write a thesis that combined these two fields. And what I thought about the field where it's really most relevant, I think, is drama. Coincidentally, and no one has asked me this, but thank you very much, I wrote my college thesis on the character of the transgressive woman in classical drama and Shakespeare, and I looked at Macbeth and the Oresteia by Agamemnon, which is the first in the Oresteia, I mean, the Oresteia by Aeschylus, which is the first, it was a trilogy. The first play is the Agamemnon. Clytemnestra is Agamemnon's wife. He's sacrificed their daughter to for a favorable outcome to sail to Troy to get some wins. And he comes back from the Trojan War and Clytemnestra kills him. And people were just like, you know, they thought that it was outrageous. He killed their daughter and I feel she'd every right to kill him in his bathtub. And then I looked at Lady Macbeth. And one of the things that I was interested in these two plays is how the way both playwrights used language around these women's violence. And the language they used was always anti-maternalistic. It was like, you know, as Lady Macbeth famously says, unsex me now, rip this baby from my breast. Clytemnestra's vocabulary around her vengeance is about like, anti-natural, anti-nature, anti-childbirth. And so I was have always been interested in the way that these women were only allowed to be seen as violent or strong in the context of not being mothers and not being wives. They just couldn't do it. Like Macbeth doesn't say like, I'm not a man or I'm not, you know, so I've been interested in that forever. I mean, that was literally my my 25th college reunion is next weekend. So we're talking a long time ago. I wrote that thing 25 years ago. And anyway, when I was conceiving this idea for this book, I was out at a bar with a friend of mine who's also randomly has a degree in ancient Greek from a totally different school. And he and I were talking about our favorite mutual author, which is Cormac McCarthy. And I was sort of interested in the way that the men in a McCarthy novel are allowed to be violent in a way women are never allowed to be violent. And I sort of made a bet with him that I was going to write a female version of Blood Meridian. So that's where the idea came from. And then, of course, as I was writing it, I remembered this idea that I often had about language and female violence from, you know, my college days.
Something else came to my mind as I was reading how you described some of the strength and the energy of the characters and being wired. And so I was thinking about your years as a competitive squash player and winning the national singles championship your single year when you were at Harvard. And I was just wondering, when you energize these female characters, how much of it comes from your experience of being an extremely competitive squash player?
It does come from some of my experiences playing squash, but not actually the competitive ones. It comes from a negative place, which is, you know, I don't know how many people out there know about squash, but you dress like it's tennis. You dress in a short skirt and it's hot and it's sweaty. And, you know, you're always lunging in the front of the court and people can see up your skirt like all the time. And you're wearing kind of skimpy clothes because it's hot out in the court. And also that's just the style. Your body is completely on display. And I felt throughout my squash career, people just felt free to comment and take advantage and say totally sexist things, you know, as opposed to, I mean, of course they complimented your squash. I mean, that goes without saying, but you were just like on display and, you know, male spectators would say the rudest things. I can't even tell you the things that were said to me. I mean, this really unpleasant. They would offer to shower with you after matches. They would just, you felt like very vulnerable, but also like a gladiator too, because you're doing this. So that sort of anger and frustration comes through here. You know, I just remember my parents would watch me play and people wouldn't know they were my parents, or even if they did, they wouldn't care. And they would just say like, look at the legs on that girl, or like just really crude things. So like some of the, and then you couldn't say anything about it. It's a polite sport. You're supposed to play. Often these people were sponsoring the tournament. So you had to like give them, like you had to be really nice to them. But some of my anger about that experience is in this book, like being a female athlete.
Deals, egging on Florida. Mm-hmm. To really act out that anger and putting them in situations where they're dealing with the sexist male who makes certain assumptions on why they were in prison and trying to, in a matter, belittle. Basically, at one point in the book, you say, you know, violence is violence.
Right.
Whether it's man or woman.
It is. And thank you for saying that. I mean, or pointing that out rather. It is like, I don't understand why it's gendered and why we're so, you know, we don't allow women the possibility to be violent. Like it's so rare or so weird. You know, if we live in a truly egalitarian society and we're trying to fight for equality on all levels between race, class, gender, whatever it is, at the very base level, everyone is capable of the same thing. I mean, yes, men and women are different. Women are physically less, you know, less have slightly less physical prowess than men, not all women and not all men. I know many women who are stronger than many men. So that means they should be equally capable of, you know, violence. Not that I'm like in favor of violence or whatever, but I just think it's really odd that, you know, we're always shocked. Like ever since, you know, classical times, people are like shocked that a woman would stand up for herself. Like Medea murders her kids. But, you know, what happened to her? And she was like kidnapped and taken away from her family, or Clytemnestra killing her husband, who like you sacrificed her daughter. It's like the worst thing you could possibly do. And like that we're shocked that they retaliate and we have to say, oh, well, she was hysterical or, you know, or she was having a, you know, she must've been out of her mind. But we would never say that about a man. And we, in fact, like, I mean, not in our society, but like in lots of societies, there are vengeance and honor killings. And like, that's a sign of pride, you know? And I just think we still have this very gendered view of what women can and should do. Not that anyone should do violence, but we can do it.
Well, I think part of the challenge is, say, for example, I have three daughters. And so having three daughters, no sons, wanting them to be the best they can be and not being limited by society's preconceived notions of what the role is of a woman. Mm-hmm. So I'll say that I've been fortunate to basically be forced to have that view, you know, because you want your daughters, you know, you want your daughters to be independent, not dependent on anybody.
It's true. And like, one of the things that I realized having been married for 10 years and having a daughter is how gendered so many things remain in our society. Like even in the most, you know, even fair family situation, the world is just set up for women to take on more of a childcare role, more of a homemaker role. I mean, the pandemic really revealed that in a lot of households. I know that personally, I wound up doing like a ton of happy homemaker stuff that I just didn't realize was going to be my job. I'm happy to do it. I love my kid more than anything on earth. But I just feel like we live in a society that is still imbalanced and gender roles are still really ingrained. And I know that we're working against that. But, you know, I go to parties with my ex-husband and people would introduce him as a TV writer and me as his wife. And I was like, yeah, not great. Like I'm a published novelist, you know, my books win awards and like, but I'm his wife or some, or, you know, she writes books, you know, but not like anything. And it's just, it's accepted that that's the way we talk. It's accepted that women are the ones who make all the dinner arrangements, like make book restaurants and organize parties. And I just like, I'm effing sick of it. I'm sorry.
Hey, look, my daughter's on the debate team.
Yeah.
In high school. She's a junior. She's been on the debate team since her freshman year. And she has come back to me, even in debate, with the sexist remarks of the males on teams that they're competing against, that her and her, the female members of the debate team actually face. Mm-hmm. And sort of this assumption that they're less than because mm-hmm. they're female debaters. So my daughter has been getting a good view of the real world.
Yeah. I mean, I just feel she's absolutely right. And even like, even a guy or a man who imagines that he is not being sexist is sort of, in my mind at least, conditioned to think, well, isn't that funny that this woman is so, you know, aggressive or so clear or so, you know, whatever on the debate team, so, you know, strident, isn't that strange? And I think like that's the part that still hasn't gotten erased. Like it's unusual that we think we see this in like we see this in the Supreme Court like Kavanaugh hearing or you know or anything. Isn't it weird that this woman is so upset? You know, isn't it weird that this woman's speaking up? We just don't take it for granted yet. And I think that's sort of the problem. And so I just took that idea and sort of pushed it the envelope a little bit further. That like, isn't it weird that this woman commits violence? Well, no, I mean, it's not weird. It's unusual. It doesn't happen a lot, but it's not weird. And it's not like, you know, unexpected.
But I thought it was weird how Dios was obsessed with Florida. But then I said, does she represent the Furies? Orestes was relentlessly pursued by the Furies. And I said, could she be the Fury and Florida Orestes?
Yes. I mean, thank you. They're not exactly a one-to-one.
Oh, yeah.
But yeah, so like, okay. Let me dial this all back. So in Blood Meridian, the character who's sort of the Dios character is named Judge Holden, the judge, right? Judge Holden. And so I was sort of thinking about that and I kind of wanted to give her a name like Justice or something like that, which just sounded really cheesy. The Orestia cycle is like one of my favorite things on earth. And in the last play, the Furies, or the Eumenides, could be called the Eumenides, which means the good ones, the Furies who've been pursuing Orestes after he killed his mother to avenge his mother killing his father, they're chasing him all over Greece, and they finally wind up in Athens, and Athena establishes a tribunal court, and she makes the Furies into the first judges of the Athenian court. So they're transformed from Furies into judges. And I was thinking about in Blood Meridian how the judge is both a judge and a Fury, because he's like this completely violent philosopher of this, like, that life is war, and that man is like, oh, you know, all of life is a war, and all of life is about killing, and that's the whole it's, I'm not going to go into his philosophy, it's pretty bananas, but
just yes. Too late.
I know I could go a lot more, but not too late. Let's say a little more about it. She is a judge. Yes, she is a judge and a Fury at the same time. She is both the sides of the Eumenides ruled into one. She's super hyper-educated. She's been taken in one of these scholarship programs that I sort of volunteer in, where they take kids who show promise from underprivileged circumstances and give them scholarships to private school. And then, you know, often into that helps you get into like an elite college.
The ABC program, called back in the day.
Yeah, this one's based on something that I worked in, which is more of a sports-oriented one. In my mind, she was a chess prodigy. And I always thought that, like, and I work very closely with students in this program. I've been a mentor forever. And one of the things I discovered in talking to my mentee, who's phenomenal, and her friends, is that it often comes with a denial of self and a denial, like you have to sort of admit in a weird way that like the way you're being raised in your background isn't acceptable. Like you have to code switch, for lack of a better expression. And it creates a sort of resentment within you. So the way you are at your preppy boarding school, where you've been lucky enough to get a scholarship, is not the way you are at home, or the way you are at home, you can't quite be there. And that's what's going on inside Dios. This is no justification for her violence, but she is both sides of this coin. She's incredibly angry and incredibly, you know, violent, but she has this weird, like, polished veneer over her. And those things are completely in conflict with each other.
Also, Sora is a little bit of a Svengali, mm-hmm. with the way she was directing mm-hmm. Florida. And, you know, over and over, she's trying to bring out the darkness. She's saying, you're not who you present yourself to be.
Yeah.
And I want to pull that out of you. And at one point, you describe Diana de Somare Sandoval mm-hmm. as a towering demon stepping toward the light. Now, that makes me think of Paradise Lost.
She's supposed to look like Judge Holden. He's like really tall and bald, and is like, it should remind you of Paradise Lost. I mean, she's like, right, she's a mythological character. And that's one of the things I really want to play with. And I think some readers aren't going to like it. Like, you know, when you read mythology, or when you read, you know, certain Westerns, people are just bad. And that they're born bad, and that's who they are. Like, there is badness in this world, and there is evil for evil's sake, and there's violence for violence's sake. And there's what I really didn't want to do. And this, I guess I should have explained this earlier. When we have violent women in fiction, or even in the real world, it's always, they can only be violent in relation to something a man has done to them. So like, we're totally fine with Thelma and Louise going on that, you know, buddy killing spree or whatever they're doing, because they've been mistreated by their husbands. Or we're fine with a woman who, you know, was abused as a kid taking revenge. Or, you know, there's a million interesting, more digestible psychological thrillers out there, you know, where a woman has like a psychological break because of something happened to her as a kid. She's secretly a serial killer, but she doesn't know because of like some childhood trauma when she was kidnapped and put in like a dungeon. See, as long as a man has done something bad to a woman, she's allowed to be violent. But a woman is not allowed to be violent because she just did something to, just wanted to, you know? So I really wanted Dios to have no explanation for her actions.
I kept looking for it too.
It's not there.
I know.
I mean, and I was like, Like No Country for Old Men, Anton Chigurh. Like no one's looking.
I read that one. I didn't read Blood Meridian, but I definitely read No Country for Old Men.
This book hews a little closer to No Country. And you know, Anton Chigurh, everyone loves him. He's got this this philosophy, two sides of the coin. If you and then he makes what's his name? I can't remember a woman flip a coin to see whether he's going to kill her or not, but he's going to kill her no matter what. Just like, you know, he was put in her path and the path is destruction. And that's Dios. Like she is like that. And I feel like this is an exercise in people putting aside their preconceptions that there has to be a reason because something bad happened to her. You know, nothing bad happened to her.
Well, you bring me to my jazz lexicon, Thelonious Monk. She is straight, no chaser.
She is straight, no chaser. I'm going to get that on a t-shirt. I want it like Dio, straight, no chaser. That's awesome.
So, Hace.
Mm-hmm.
The narrator of the story, she starts it off. She's telling the story, secondhand story, and she has voices that talk to her, ghosts that talk to her.
Mm-hmm.
Talk about the creation of that character.
Yeah, so that came a little bit later. I feel like how can I explain it? Dios and Florida, they're not unreliable, but they're very, very wrapped up in their story and they're very close to it and they don't have a lot of distance from what's going on. And Case is sort of a more balanced view, although she is also a killer, a murderer, accidentally, I guess. And she's sort of, I wanted her, as you pointed out in the beginning, to sort of be like a Greek chorus or sort of like a Western gather around this fireplace and fire pit, let me tell you a story. And I just wanted her to give I needed a way to give a larger context to what was going on in the prison and what was going on like Dios and Florida are sort of extreme versions. Dios is completely unrepentant and Florida is in complete denial that she's criminal. Case is completely aware of what she did, although she doesn't remember doing it, which is sort of, she does. Sorry, somebody else. That's Tina. Case, she is sort of more of a traditional prisoner. And I felt you needed that balance. Also, I love that she tells the story and she's sort of a softer take. I really thought, and then as I was writing her, I just loved her voice and she's disturbed, but she is also rational at the same time in the way that the other characters aren't. And I like to play with these conceptions that like, you know, I work in Skid Row, I am back teaching there, which I probably need to update in my bio. And like, there are people there who have, severe issues and neuroatypicality and, mental health issues, but they're also rational and they're also have real thoughts and real concerns and valid. And I wanted Case to be that way, that we, someone whose story we would ignore because of her past and what she's done, but she's really interesting. She's really soulful. She's really kind actually. And she's sort of a good person despite having done a bad thing.
Well, the other interesting thing I'm thinking about going back to Florida again is how she continues in her mind to want to get back to the life she had before.
Yeah, good luck.
What is it about the Jaguar and speed?
It's funny. There's this thing in screenwriting called get the goods, you a plot where everyone's trying to get like the national treasure or get to a certain place. And it just was like an engine for her to pulling her back to LA. It's completely irrational on her part because, she's basically guilty of driving a getaway car. And it shows that she just completely doesn't understand what she's done or is in denial of what she's done. And she just thinks if she gets in her classic Jaguar, she can, escape her circumstances. Also she's very LA and I wanted her to have some sort of, I like each of my characters to have like a thing they're obsessed with that's sort of their lodestone. And for her, it's this car that, you know, she's probably never going to drive again. But yeah, it's just her, what's pulling her back home.
I wish someone would write a novel where the protagonist is obsessed with gumbo and make it a roof from scratch.
Oh, okay. That sounds great. I mean, I can make a
blonde. I'm from New Orleans. I can't help it.
I can make a blonde roux pretty well. I make them a lot. I make shrimp Creole all the time. It's like my favorite, one of my favorite dishes to cook. I would be obsessed with a gumbo if I was a
dark
person.
Roux. Dark I'm obsessed roux, like with
dark.
The dark roux.
You like a dark roux.
The dark brown roux. That's the obsession. But to get back to the story, many times I hear people say, I don't understand why they did something. Because we're looking at what they did from the limited view of our eyes.
Right.
Right. And there are many things that from the outside look irrational to somebody mm-hmm. else, but they don't know what's the story behind why they do what they do. And what I like is everybody has some sort of rosebud. Is it rosebud?
Yeah, rosebud. Yeah.
Rosebud. You know, they have that something that just now you know mine, gumbo, right?
Right.
I'm on death row. My last meal, gumbo. That's it. So I just think sometimes people assume that everyone should think and interpret the world that they, the way they do, when the reality is we have to be able to take a step back and understand different experiences that people have. I mean, there will be different things that are their totem.
Well, also, like, violence is irrational and crime is irrational, unless it's like bank robbery or whatever, or premeditated, like, you know, but a lot of crime is irrational. A lot of it happens in the spur of the moment. Like, why did I do that? I don't know. And like, one of the things that I think is problematic when we look for a reason that a character or a person in real life does something, we're looking for that reason in the moment, you know, like, why did Florida do this getaway car pipe bomb thing with her drug dealer friend. It's not why she did it on like that particular Saturday night. It's like, we have to go back and look at like, you know, it's just a series of events and it's a series of things that are leading up to it. And this is not to justify or rationalize like what I'm saying, like there's some childhood trauma that led her to do it. It's like there's a ladder of things. So like when people are looking for an explanation, the explanation often isn't right there preceding the action. It's a series of things that lead you closer and closer to destruction. And this is something I talk about in all of my books, is that like, there's often, you know, there's often like a moment you can pinpoint where you took that first step away from a traditional or safe path. Or like anti-criminal path or whatever it is in what character is doing, there's that first step. And then there's a series of other steps. And like, you know, Dios has been violent in her past. She talks about that. And so it's not like, why did she do this particular grisly thing on a bus in my book? It's like, well, yeah, because it's like accumulation of things. So like, I think people are wrong to look for explanations the way they do. And I think it's okay not to present the explanation fully, because that's the way the real world is. You know, we don't know people fully. And I think, you know, it is sort of a failure of novelists to always have to over-explain and to justify, because readers need that. You know, people act in the moment, but that action is sort of a result of a cumulative amount of other incidents that you don't technically know.
You deal with class issues, especially when we get a little bit of background on Dios being mm-hmm. the scholarship student and right. the things she's having to deal with on the East Coast College and the way she perceives Florida, Florence. Right. So talk a little bit about that class tension that runs throughout this novel.
Yeah. So, I mean, as I said earlier, Dios has grown up in this same kind of world as Florence did when she goes to high school and college. She goes to a very ritzy high school based on a prep school in Brooklyn, not the one I went to. And then she goes to a bucolic New England college, unnamed, outside of Boston, in the country. So she is very aware of that world. And she's very aware of what she would have to do to be part of that world and what her, the amount of like self-negation, you know, she would have to undergo, because to be her in that world is not acceptable. She has to be them. And I mean, there, I have, this is awful because I really love the organizations that I work for. I have to say that there is a limitation. There's a lot of charitable giving, and there's a lot of, you know, very affluent Upper East Side people who give to these organizations, but there is a sort of lack of empathy or understanding or acceptance of the people that they are helping. They can only help them as much as they can, you know, there's a lack of acceptance, I think. And I think a lot of the people like Dios are othered, and they're just kept, you know, it's okay. The charity sort of goes one way. I know this is really negative. So the class issue, and then, but I've wanted Dios to sort of take the gift she has been given, the opportunity of this education, to dismantle the givers of the opportunity. So she sees behind the curtain. They give her this access to the world that they want her to join, but she sees this as an opportunity to dismantle that world. They gave her the keys to the kingdom, and she sees, you know, how fraudulent it is and how she'll never really accept it. And they gave those keys to the absolute wrong person, because she is not, she's not a gentle human being. So the she sees both sides of the class issue, because she's been, you know, exposed to affluence and a really great education, but also she knows that these things are only given to her in as much as she plays by the rules, and she's not a role player.
And as she shares with Dios, I learned what makes them tick. Violence and fear, same as anyone else. And I learned how quickly they can turn, how quickly their charity turns to hatred.
Exactly. So just stay in line, code switch, be quiet. And then if you, you know, say the wrong word or dress the wrong way, or, you know, bring the wrong person around who's a little more not polished, you know, all of these are strikes against you. So yeah, I mean, you know, for the most part, I think this doesn't always happen, but I have seen it and I'm interested in it. Yeah.
Makes me also think of a novel, sort of a bit of an analogy here. It's called The Spook Who Sat by the Door.
Okay.
And so in this novel's written in early 1970s. It's about an African-American that goes to work for the CIA and takes everything he learns from working for the CIA to help organize the Black Revolution.
Yes, exactly. I mean, that's sort of what it is. And I was sort of, and there's been a sea change in the organizations that I work for and am involved in, which is now they're calling for people of color leading them. I mean, a lot of these organizations are started by white people because they have the ability to fundraise. And they are fundraising from really, really elite places like JP Morgan and, you know, huge private wealth management firms. And those are traditionally male run and white run. And then the donors are of that ilk. And then the organizers and the directors are sort of white men. And now a lot of the graduates of these programs are saying, well, we need organizers that represent us, you know? And so that's changing, but it's taken a while. And sort of Dios, she's like, again, she's an exaggeration. Like, I'm not going to say there's a million Dioses out there. There's probably a few. I mean, I know there's a few. But she's taken this and really exaggerated it as an opportunity to expose the fallacy of charity and to also show like the mistake they made in taking a chance on her without paying attention.
Was writing this book any different from writing any of your other books?
I mean, in the sense that I wrote it during COVID, in like 1.5 hour breaks from going to kindergarten with my kid online. Yeah, it was a little different. It was a little different. And then my life changed dramatically while I was writing it.
Okay. So where do you stand now in terms of your next literary project?
I don't stand so I haven't started. I have an idea. I just haven't. Oh, sorry. I have this idea where I just need to start writing it. So that's the problem. And it's just been a very big year where I've where I have, you know, I got divorced, I moved out of my house, I got a new house. But I think I'm gonna start writing in the fall. And I was, you know, it's not, I don't know. I mean, I'm hopefully, I don't want to write such a dark novel. Like, I think I want to write like a novel that's not personally dark about humanity, but more like apocalyptically dark about society. Because it's not going to be sunny, but I kind of want to write a book that has like a family. I don't know. It's going to be different. Like, this book was like, Sing Her Down is definitely an evolution from Wonder Valley, These Women Sing Her Down. I see them as a continuum. I thought it was going to be the end of an LA trilogy, but there's a fourth book. And I really want to talk about I'm still very fascinated with like living in Los Angeles as an exercise in like disaster. Like, we live at the edge of disaster. I mean, it's crazy. It's going to rain today. And people are like, oh, so I mean, it's great that it's going to rain. We need it. But like, it's not supposed to rain in May. You know, it's just, that's weird. It's been cold. And it feels really strange. It feels like the climate is changing dramatically. The El Nino is coming this year and it's going to destroy the coastline. Seawater is going to be warm. The fisheries are going to be suffering. Mudslides, fires. And I'm just like, I dealt with that a little bit in These Women, but I'm not okay with it. And I feel like we are just on the verge of a disaster. And there's a selfishness about living in LA that I want to talk about. So of course, I'm sure I'm going to start writing it as soon as we have goddamn dark crime novel. But we shall see.
So I didn't tell you this in advance, but if you could maybe think of some writers or novels you recently have really been excited about. Something that you've read recently or writers you're like, wow.
I read Jonathan Lethem's new book. It's coming out in fall, which is not helpful because it hasn't come out yet, but I absolutely love it. And it's called Brooklyn Crime Novel. And we grew up really close to each other. And I just think this is like, I will be able to give it to my daughter and say, this is my childhood, even though he's a bit older than me. I read a book recently called Dirty Weekend Helen, I can't pronounce her last name. It's a book about a woman who goes on a killing spree in England, and it's very over the top and relentless, but it has some of the best dialogue I've read in a book in my entire life. I just was blown away by the quality of the dialogue in that. What else have I read? I always want to say that Susan Strait's book, Mecca, which is one of the best books I read in the last year, was just phenomenal and just a triumph of literature and just like one of the most important books written about Southern California and all the people who live here. It just should be required reading for everybody everywhere who wants to understand the diversity and makeup of where we live.
Well, that was a great response.
Oh, thanks.
It just rolled off your tongue.
Oh, I know. Cool.
Ivy Pakoda, author of Sing Her Down. I love the novel.
Thank you.
I'm just a fan of Ivy Pakoda.
Thank you.
I'm going to read everything she does. Thank you so much for being a guest on Diverse Voices Book Review.
Thank you so much. It was such a pleasure. And I can't wait to write another book and come back.
Thank you for listening to Diverse Voices Book Review. I'm Hopeton Hay, host and producer. The theme music is provided by Wright Productions. You can follow the show on social media. Under Facebook and Instagram, it's Diverse Voices Book Review, or Twitter under @DiverseBooksHay.